This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Among them are people suffering from malaria or other illnesses. Many have suffered from trauma after witnessing violent incidents, including armed men reportedly murdering and raping civilians and looting villages.
That's UN Refugee Agency spokesman Babar Balogh talking about people fleeing fresh violence in South Sudan. Details coming up. Also, gunmen attacked a hospital in the volatile Western Cameroon's Anglophone area, killing at least four people. And Zimbabwe Teachers Union says they have suspended the strike they started last week. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Nigeria's top two candidates for Saturday's presidential election are not new to politics, or for that matter, running for president in Africa's most populous nation. But the race between President Muhammadu Buhari and challenger Atiku Abubakar is not just close in terms of who could win, but also on the main campaign issues. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Two political heavyweights, both former leaders in their 70s, are vying for the top office in Nigeria. 76-year-old incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari swept to power in 2015 on promises to improve Nigeria's security, oil-dependent economy, and reputation for rampant corruption. His opponent, 72-year-old former vice president and businessman Atiku Abubakar, is campaigning on a similar platform. Analyst Julian Parker has been studying Nigeria for a decade and says this year's poll, with its striking similarities to previous polls, might provoke apathy among voters.
These two frontrunners in the election race have been in politics for decades. This is not their first time either for running for president. Between them, they've nearly run for the presidency 10 times.
Both men have stressed the need for greater security, particularly in the fight against Islamist militants in the north, and for economic diversity, away from Nigeria's dependence on oil. While their words on the other crucial issue, corruption, are similar, their reputations differ. Buhari made clean governance his signature issue and is widely described in Nigeria as incorruptible. But in an interview with VOA, he agreed with critics that corruption has not been wiped out.
Yes, there will always be people who will be prepared to offer bribes. But what we feel is just like the military operation. Whoever is caught accepting bribe, will certainly be dealt with.
But Abubakar, known as Atiku to his followers, is dogged by corruption allegations, which he quickly denied in an interview with VOA. He said he plans to take a hardline approach on corruption as well.
You just have to strengthen your laws and also strengthen your processes to make sure that people don't escape, and also make sure that people who are accused of corruption, tried in a very, very fast manner, so that you don't allow, I certainly will not agree or allow a situation where corrupt trials last for several years.
While some analysts predict a tight presidential race, it could come down to demographics and identity politics. But Parker says voters should also look at Buhari's health problems. He spent several months of his first term living abroad and receiving treatment for an unspecified illness.
Buhari's health is a huge factor. It's a huge source of concern for a lot of people, investing in Nigeria in terms of, is he going to be able to complete his term? What does that mean for the political stability?
She notes that Buhari is backed by a popular deputy, Oluyemi Osinbajo.
We know that Buhari will, if he has to, will hand over to his deputy. And his deputy is actually a very dynamic, business-friendly, young guy who's got quite a lot of national appeal. He's been able to broker peace in the rest of Niger Delta region.
In December, Buhari denied rumors he had died and been replaced by a body double. As for his health, he said, he is going strong. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Nigerian politicians are bristling at warnings by foreign governments about possible violence and cheating in this Saturday's presidential election, saying the statements undermine public confidence in the process. Festus Keyemo, spokesman for the re-election campaign of President Muhammadu Buhari, called the statements from the United States, Britain and the European Union notably off-key when they should be encouraging credible elections. A key Buhari ally, Kaduna State Governor Nasir El-Rufai, earlier said outsiders who intervened in the elections will go back in body bags. The U.S. and Britain have previously said they will impose visa bans on anyone implicated in vote rigging or violence. While the field of presidential candidates is large, Buhari and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar are seen as the overwhelming favorites. Nigeria's last election in 2015 was considered free and fair, but the former British colony has a history of election violence and fraud allegations. The United Nations Refugee Agency says a surge of violence in South Sudan's Equatoria state has displaced some 8,000 civilians and sent an estimated 5,000 people fleeing to the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Clashes between the South Sudanese army and a rebel group, the National Salvation Front, or NAS, broke out on January 19th. This was barely 4 months after the latest peace deal aimed at ending the country's five-year civil war was signed by President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar. UN Refugee Agency spokesman Babar Baloch tells VOA, violence has been going down since then, and he says the two major parties that signed the accord appear to be sticking to it.
Let's not forget, South Sudan has over 70 factions in terms of small groups and rebel groups. And NAS, as far as I understand, is led by Thomas Cirilo. And we also understand that his group refused to sign the peace agreement.
The fighting reportedly is taking place outside the town of Yei, close to the borders of the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda. Baller says most of those fleeing by foot to Congo are women, children, and the elderly. He says they arrive exhausted, hungry, thirsty, and in some cases sick.
Among them are people suffering from malaria or other illnesses. Many have suffered from trauma after witnessing violent incidents, including armed men reportedly murdering and raping civilians and looting villages.
The refugees are arriving in remote border villages in Congo's Ituri province, an area close to Ebola-affected North Kivu province. A World Health Organization spokesman says there's no indication the disease has spread to this region, but he says the risk is there, so border crossings are being monitored carefully. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Gunmen attacked a hospital in Kumba, the commercial hub in the volatile Western Cameroon's Anglophone area, burning down the building and killing at least four people. Separatists earlier had announced plans to disrupt yesterday's anniversary of the 1961 referendum that linked Cameroon's western English-speaking areas with the French-speaking areas that had just won independence from France. Anglophone separatists have been fighting troops in the region, attacking police stations and schools, and staging mass kidnappings. United Nations figures show around 437,000 people have been forced from their homes, with 32,000 more fleeing to neighboring Nigeria. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Fifteen past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Nigerian politicians are bristling at warnings by foreign governments about possible violence and cheating in this Saturday's presidential election. The United Nations Refugee Agency says a surge of violence in South Sudan's Equatorial State has displaced some 8,000 civilians. And gunmen attacked a hospital in the volatile Western Cameroon's Anglophone area, killing at least 4 people. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The Libyan National Army, headed by General Khalifa Haftar, says it has control of El Sharar oil field, which produces 1/3 of Libya's oil. Tribes in the south had seized the oil field, demanding that the Tripoli government do more to move the area out of poverty. The Libyan National Army says its forces will hand over the field to the national oil company based in Tripoli. Rhiannon Smith is managing editor of the Libya Analysis Consulting Group in London. She explained to VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi how Haftar's southward push could affect the United Nations plan to convene a national conference that could lead to elections.
The LNA under Khalifa Haftar has launched a sort of military operation in the south of Libya over the last 2 or 3 weeks. And just in the last week, they moved on Sharara oil field, which it's an important oil field in the south of Libya. It produces a significant portion of the country's oil. The oil field had been closed for the last month by different local forces who wanted to put pressure on the Tripoli government to pay them more salaries and to address some of the issues in the south. Now, by the LNA going to Sharara and taking control of it, this allows them to sort of demonstrate themselves as the saviors of the south. It allows them to demonstrate that they are supporting the southern communities and to gain a lot of support there. By handing over the oil field to the NOC, this is again showing them that they are the ones that are basically securing Libya's oil, securing Libya's economy, and this is a very powerful message. Now, although the LNA have said that they've got full control of Sharara, this should be taken with a pinch of salt. Although the forces are at the field now and they've actually struck deals with local forces to be able to get control there, it's still a very volatile situation. We could easily see clashes erupting and the LNA losing control again of the field. The other important thing to note is that although the LNA is saying they will give control to the NOC, the NOC is still saying that they want to secure their staff and ensure that the infrastructure is properly secured before reopening. So it may well be another few weeks before we see the oil field reopening and anything significant actually changing in the region.
So how would the continued military activities by General Haftar's forces impact the UN long-prepared plans to convene a Libyan national conference, which is supposed to lead to parliamentary and presidential elections?
It could have a number of effects. It could derail, actually, the UN political process. This is because the LNA has always been quite reluctant to really commit to the national conference process and to commit to striking a compromise with the GNA and other parties. However, the LNA, through this southern operation, through sort of demonstrating themselves as the protectors of the south and reopening or trying to reopen the oil fields, they've actually gained a lot of support among societies and communities in the south and also in some parts of western Libya. So the LNA is likely now hoping that it can continue to gain this kind of social and political support, that it can undermine in doing so the credibility and legitimacy of the GNA. And actually it means that it won't need to compromise or commit to the UN process, but that rather it will be able to take control or gain influence across the country through direct elections or through its own means. It could be that the national conference does continue to go ahead, but rather that the LNA will just be the dominant party within that political process. Because what could also happen and what we are starting to see is that the kind of hostilities between the GNA and the LNA could increase, and that could make actually the whole political situation in Libya deteriorate quite quickly and see a worsening of the situation.
How would you describe the Haftar's motives behind the southward push, especially with France's support and backing?
I think his key aim is legitimacy and credibility, both among Libyan populations and in the international community. He's targeting ISIS and Al-Qaeda members in that area, and in doing so, he's gaining a lot of support among southern communities who have been isolated and ignored by the coastal authorities for a very long time. But he's also playing into international actors. So France, for a long time, has been involved in Chad. They are supporting his kind of anti-Chadian rebel, anti-terrorist operations, and they've supported him. So again, in doing this, Haftar is showing himself as the man who can secure security in Libya, not just on the coast, but also in the south and where it counts for some of these kind of counter-terror operations in the wider Sahel region.
That was Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the Libya Analysis Consulting Group. She spoke to my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Zimbabwe's teachers' unions say they have suspended the strike they started last week for better pay in light of rising inflation, erosion of salaries, and high costs of living. Reporter Kuzwai Zanawashi has details.
Speaking on the eve of the strike last week, Richard Gundani, president of the Zimbabwe Teachers Association, explained the reasons.
We saw prices going up. We saw a new surge in inflation, which escalated to hyperinflationary levels. And what that meant is that the salaries of teachers was drastically eroded. So this is the situation where we find ourselves in, where now the teacher is way below the poverty datum line.
Monday, the chief executive officer of Zimbabwe Teachers Association, Sifiso Ndlovu, explained why they had suspended the strike.
There is a feeling that people say we have called off the strike. Calling off the strike would have a different connotation, but suspending the strike is in itself a temporal truce that we would like to have with our members and with the employer so that we can facilitate the issue of discussions, the issue of dialogue.
Ndlovu says the strike has changed attitude of stakeholders participating in the National Joint Negotiating Council, adding that they had to quickly resolve the developing hostile situation for teachers.
Then the other condition under which we suspended the strike was the issue of promise of the safety of the educators. So we don't want to take the lives of educators and place them at risk. The desire to be at work was there, but the also desire to survive was there. These are two conflicting areas.
Munyara Dzidodo is the editor of Open Parli, an online publication that covers parliament and political developments. He says the plight of teachers is linked to Zimbabwe's economic crisis.
Prices have increased by up to 200 and 250%, but the teachers' salaries have only gone up by 10%. So that is the root cause. Their salaries cannot help them to go to work. Everything is slowly grinding to a halt. The reality is they won't be able to afford bus fare or come to work.
Some teachers strongly feel the strike was called off prematurely before its intended results were achieved. Ndlovu, however, feels the renewed energy and optimism in the negotiations will go a long way in resolving the plight of teachers. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinavashi from Harare.
Rwanda's justice sector is launching an anti-corruption week to bolster a fight against corruption in all sectors, including the justice offices. Though the government has created measures to fight corruption, some people think the laws seem to target the poor and spare those in high government posts. Eugene Uimana has more from Kigali.
In 59 cases of corruption in the court system, many suspects are listed as jobless. The Deputy Chief Justice Kaitesi Sidivisa Inabo explains this image of corruption suspects from last year and the beginning of 2019. When you analyze the level that include many suspects, 23 are qualified as unemployed or farmers, 19 drivers, and 14 small businessmen. That leaves the unidentified big fish. that are invisible to most people or are considered to be untouchable. One name has become familiar nationwide. Caleb Byiringiro is a small businessman in Kigali. He explains how it's a pity that the system pursues suspects who eat little money to get their services delivered, but lets those who swallow billions in public funds run free.
Look, we always hear people who were found guilty of corruption are drivers, motorcyclists, who eat 2,000 or 500. But what about those in high government institutions? The Auditor General annually releases reports of how public institutions misuse the money, or the parliament summons different leases of embezzlement of public funds, but they don't get punished. They keep enjoying their salaries. That's unjust.
For Ingabire Makile, the chairperson of Transparency International Rwanda, those big fishes who misuse the government money have high responsibilities and powers that help them stay out of touch. Who are those named big fishes? You find them in sensitive public service, in infrastructure, and in very respectful offices. That is worse than a simple corruption. It is embarrassment. Jean Bosco Mutangana, the prosecutor general, also admits that some high-level officials get involved in corruption. He pledges to do everything to bring them to court with the new law that punishes embezzlement as corruption. But he warns that dragging them is not easy. We normally say that none is above the law, but we admit that there are powerful persons in the country. We can't wait to catch them. Those who deal with public tenders, those who deal with the government budget, leaders in different levels, get heavily in corruption. I can't deny to bring them to book is not easy, but the new law of following them as corruption suspects will highly help us. Rwanda is running ranked third least corrupt country in Africa, according to the 2018 Corruption Perception Index. Globally, Rwanda is the 48th least corrupt nation, improving 2 places from 2016. But critics say these figures may not include the invisible corrupt officials and businessmen. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu, host of Health Chat. Next week on Health Chat, we'll discuss measles as countries such as Madagascar and the United States are grappling with the disease. For your questions or comments, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The U.S. country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. Health Chat this Tuesday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Nigeria's presidential election is set for February 16th. President Muhammadu Buhari of the APC and top challenger Atiku Abubakar of the PDPs are both Fulani Muslims. A discussion on what's at stake on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.